Hello and welcome to Radio Prague with me, Ian Willoughby. In today's special programme, we meet Tomáš Lom, an RAF veteran who's today well into his 90s and has lived a truly fascinating life.
We'll meet again, don't know when, don't know when. But I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
Tomáš Lom is one of the very few surviving Czechoslovaks who served in Britain's RAF during World War II. Born Tomáš Lovenstein into a Jewish family in Prague, he signed up in London the moment he turned 18 and ended up serving as a wireless operator in the Bahamas in the latter period of the conflict. Mr. Lom and his family had settled in the UK after fleeing Czechoslovakia just days before the Nazi invasion in 1939. Indeed, his father, Professor Arnold Lovenstein, an ophthalmologist, remained in Scotland after the war. Tomáš Lom has a ready laugh and is in remarkable shape for, as he puts it, 93 and a half. When we spoke recently in his cosy home in a leafy district on the outskirts of Prague, he shared the fascinating story of his war years.
In 1940, I came up to Glasgow, entered Glasgow University in a bachelor's course. After 2 years, I was 18 years of age and reported to the Czech embassy for service because I was very keen on teaching the Germans a lesson. I wanted to be in the Air Force, but the embassy put me into the army depot at Cholmondeley. There I did army service, and it took every possibility to demand to be transferred to the Air Force.
But why were you so keen to join the Air Force? Why did you want to be in the RAF?
Well, you see, after I heard what had happened in Austria, in Germany, and probably also in view of the very efficient propaganda Churchill and his party, I was absolutely keen to teach the Germans a lesson. And in the Czech army, doing parades in England just didn't satisfy me. The Air Force was the only Czech armed force which really fought in those days. I just had one opportunity to get away from Cholmondeley. That was when I had 24 hours duty at the gate, and sometime before sunrise, I heard a horde of absolutely drunk soldiers returning to base. So I knew nobody took that serious, but I took it serious and wanted them to tell me the password for the day. They told me, "Don't be an ass, the camp commander is with me." I said, "I don't know him, I want to hear the password." They got louder and louder. I was adamant too, until the commander of our guard group came out, obediently opened the gate, and of course they had to do something with me for being cheeky to the camp commander. On the other hand, they didn't want this to get too much publicity, so they sent me off to the Air Force.
When you joined the Czech Army, hoping to get into the Air Force, you had just reached military age. Who were the other Czech men who were around you in the Czech Army? I guess they had a different kind of life experience to you. They would have been older than you, I presume.
Well, there were all sorts of Czechs arriving at Cholmondeley, at the army base. Evacuees who had come of age as me. And from the butcher works all over the world.
So were there many 18-year-olds like you?
Yes, there were lots of 18 to 20 who were just of military age group.
And when you did get into the RAF, what specifically were you doing in the Royal Air Force?
Well, I'll take it historically, stage by stage. The first month was just learning to parade the English way with four stamps on about turn, with your arms stretched out like along a ruler, and learning that the left side is port, the right side is starboard, that the English ranks are from AC2 to wing commander or something like that. Well, as I said, after about a month of these basic necessities, a committee arrived which had to select who was down to ground crews, who was to airborne, in the airborne, who was to be pilot, who was to be radio, who was to be navigator, and so on. Well, of course, I wanted to be a fighter pilot, but no luck. I was selected for radio service. That means in no time I was sent to No. 1 radio schools. For about 2 months or so, we did ground Morse code training, and after that, we did exercises in airborne stations, radio stations, because I had some idea about the theory of radio from my physics training in Scotland. I was held on for onboard radio mechanics. That was quite interesting, learning the details of onboard radio stations, although I very much doubt if I could have soldered up a radio station with flak or something destroyed in the air.
And how well had your training prepared you for the realities of flying missions for the RAF?
After the Grenville, after the radio training, I got my sergeant stripes and half wing of a signal service in the air, and then I had to do another course for air gunners at Barrow in Furness. After about a month of that, I was sent off to the 311 Squadron, Czech Squadron at Tain. There I arrived just before Christmas in 1944 and was assigned to a crew of CIMET. Luckily for me, not for the man who did it, a chap with the same training as me asked me if he could change my assignment. He had friends in CIMET's crew and wanted to exchange it with me. So I said, well, if you arrange it, I have no friends here or in any other crew, so I'll change it. This was one of the moments when my guardian angel really kicked me into the right position, because CIMET had a very nasty crash, and most of his crew were killed on the place. I went to the crew, Horishi, on the contrary to CIMET, was an excellent pilot, and when we had an accident in the air, and the control wires to rudder snapped, and he had to make the landing without rudder control, that was no problem for him.
What kind of missions were you flying in? And were you involved in many hairy ones?
Well, there were one or two occasions when the outcome was less than even. But as I said, my angel who had me in charge always kept a hand above me. So when, as I said, we had the fire on board, the control wires that snapped were not the elevators, but the rudder, the direction control, because if the elevator control wire snapped, there would be no possibility of preventing a disaster. Well, after some 2 months, we did an operational flight, a sort of in the region between Norway and Iceland. The weather was horrible. We were all airsick, and Horeshi was very sensible. He told us, don't try to get into the tail gun turret. You wouldn't be able to hit anything and might even hit our own plane. So we spent that mission at the side windows, which was at least fresh air. I tried to work my radar, but there was so much interference that I didn't hear a thing in my earphones. When we landed, they said, "You are still alive? We thought you'd be drowned by now. You didn't respond to our mission canceled back to base call." I didn't know if it was me or somebody else who didn't hear it on the phone. Not long after this, the squadron commander called me to tell me that I had to pack up my kit bag and was ordered to number 111 OTU, Operational Training Unit at Nassau, Bahamas.
I was reading about that, and I was wondering, I'm really curious, why were you sent to the Bahamas?
Well, I asked the commander that I was happy to be in the operational 311 squadron, and if he couldn't send to the Bahamas somebody else, he said, "No, that's an order. I need a man of your profession, of your training, a man who doesn't need an escort to get him to Nassau, who wouldn't get lost on the way. So about turn and get going."
Were there many Czechs in the Bahamas?
Yes, on the Bahamas, our Czech crews were assigned to the OTU Bahamas, where we did pre-operational training on two-engined Mitchells, where the pilot had to get used to the front nose undercarriage, and the others were more or less to support his circuit and bumps flying training. I had my radio set behind the bomb bay in the Mitchell. In the Mitchell, there was a floor window just in the tail where I had to lie down and report hits and misses during low-level bombing. I was a stupid ass, so I really reported what I saw, which means that the pilot was quite angry because he had so many misses. So when I said I didn't see any explosion, he got rather angry and told me, "If you didn't sleep down there, you'd see it. Watch better next time." Closed the bomb bay and did an elegant right turn, an escape maneuver, but unluckily I was right. The bomb was still dangling on the support. On his escape maneuver, it dropped down and exploded in the closed bomb bay. This destroyed our hydraulic system, and we were instructed to do all sorts of maneuvers to shake the undercart out into landing position. In the end, we had one gear down, locked in the landing position and the front nose too, but the left landing gear was dangling down. As a matter of fact, the pilot instructor, Johnny Irving, a Czech who had served up more than 1,000 operational flying hours and spent his additional flying service on the Bahamas, circled around us and told our pilot what to do to shake the landing gear out. This was of no avail, so when he had used up most of the petrol, our pilot just went in for a landing and made a perfect landing on the right wheel and held the left wing up as long as possible. But when he lost speed, the left wing came down on the ground and we spun around a few times before coming to a halt. When we got out, we were happy that all of us survived without any injury.
In those days, I'm sure world travel was quite unusual. What was it like going from the UK, you'd only been in the UK and here, to such an exotic place as the Bahamas?
Well, when we arrived at New York, they carted us off by lorry to a US Army camp north of the city. There we deposited our English gear and got United States tropic gear instead. After a day or two sightseeing in New York, we left New York by train for Florida. It took about 2 days journey or 2 nights in sleepers, which you know from the film Some Like It Hot. Exactly those sleeping cars it was. When we got to Miami, again, it didn't look like you know it from today's films, but again, you know it from Some Like It Hot. In the evening, we boarded a steamer, something like our Vltava riverboat, and in the morning, we disembarked at Nassau, where we assigned to the smaller aerodrome where there were 2 engined Mitchells.
What impression did the place make on you, the nature, the sea, everything?
That, of course, was an enormous impression for me. And when I was free, some off-duty, I loved to stroll through the native harbor where the native fishermen had their sailing boats. There I met a Dutch man who was also training for a radio operator, and he offered me to take me off for a ride on a native sailing boat. So we spent a couple of very exciting outings on this sailing boat to an island, a deserted island, where we found coconuts underground, or I could climb up a palm to shake them down. But I assure you that climbing poles and ropes in the gymnasium is far more agreeable than climbing up a palm tree.
When the war ended, you were in your early 20s. Coming back to Czechoslovakia wasn't your only option. I believe your father was still in Glasgow. Why and when did you return to Czechoslovakia?
Well, to be quite honest, I wasn't sure that England liked me as a refugee, although they were most friendly when I was there only for the duration, or an ally. So I had practically no objections when in the Czech Air Force I was moved to Prague. Here I got rid of my uniform as soon as possible and returned to the physics study at Prague University.
Many of the Czechoslovaks who served in the RAF were later terribly mistreated by the communists. They were imprisoned. Did anything like that happen to you?
When I was studying physics at Karlovy University at Prague, a friend of mine with whom I had very exciting discussions about the future applications of physical principles, one day turned the discussion to political questions. I told him, politics is something like environment. It's good to know something about it because you know what you can expect, but there is no way you can influence it. And he asked me, well, but if you had to choose, which party would you choose? I said, well, none of the existing ones. The only party which is a bit to my liking is Hašek's party of slow social progress within the laws, as permitted by the laws. My friend got rather furious and told me, well, Tom, I shan't let you do your physics degree with such political ignorance. You'll have to join the party. Well, as I said, I was quite leftish after my stay in England. I said, well, why not? So I joined the party, and that enabled me to do my physics degree, and practically without harm, I finished physics, did applied physics and electronics in the Czech Tesla Electronic Works, down to my pension.
After the war, you changed your family name from Lowenstein or Lovenstein, or I don't know how you pronounced it, to Lum. Why did you change your name?
Well, to be quite honest, it wasn't my idea, but my brother's. He told me, well, I'm fed up telling everybody how to spell this Lowenstein. I'm changing my name to Lum. I said, fine, I'll join you. So up to 1945, I was Lowenstein, and from 1945, I'm Lama.
But was any part of that an attempt to avoid anti-Semitism or anything like that?
Of course, it was mainly an attempt not to be joined with the bloody Germans, bloody Jews, and so on. But
you were Jewish.
I am by the German laws, the Nazi laws, I am 100% Jew, but my grandfather was the founder of the Volnamischdenker, the free thinkers at Karlovy Vary. My father was absolutely not aware of his Jewish roots, and so was I. Just another little interlude. When I was at Cosford, some officer had to fill in my identity card or identity or a full page of it, and he wanted my nationality. When I told him Czechoslovak, he told him there is no Czechoslovak nationality. You can be a Jew, a German, anything else. What was your mother tongue? Which school, which maternity school did you visit? I said, German, to the officer. I said, well, in that case, you were German in those days, and you can't change your nationality as same as a dirty shirt. So you will have to write in German. I said, well, I'm not going to sign this. So I left my questionnaire unsigned.
My final question is, today, so many years later, how do you look back on your years in the RAF, in the war?
Well, it was very exciting. I got through many adrenaline experiences where the probability of getting through was rather under 50%. So I must say I was lucky as a pig. Is it a pig?
Not sure.
Very lucky to get through it like this.
That was RAF veteran Tomasz Lum, who I recently had the enormous pleasure of meeting. I hope you enjoyed his story just as much as I did, and that you can join us again soon here on Radio Prague. From me, Ian Willoughby, thank you very much indeed for listening, and enjoy the rest of your weekend.
We'll meet again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
The shepherd will tend his sheep, the valley will bloom again, and Jimmy will go.